All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the 411 Ground and Pound MMA podcast. We are your weekly look into the wide, wacky, wonderful world of mixed martial arts. My name is Robert Winfrey, as always, and I am your host, pretty much per usual there. What do we got tonight? Well, last night, UFC on ESPN 53, which was about as good as expected. Somebody point, Gribaka Hitman, at Kaposa on Twitter, brought up that, this card was a good example of why bout order matters. And I think that played out in practice. Like, this is still not a great card even under ideal circumstances, but some of the fights on the prelims really should have been on the main card, and that co-main event should not have been the co-main event. I don't know who's overly fetishizing the use of heavyweights in the apex in main and co-main event positions, but fire them, please. It would have helped. It really would have helped. Wouldn't have saved it, and by and large, it was a slog. Hey, we'll put heavyweights in the co-main event. Really, one of these guys is a notorious decision machine. You think that's a good idea? Man, finishes were at a giant premium, in fact, for that whole card. There were, what, 14 or 15 fights. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Oh, 13? Yeah, 13 fights, sorry. Felt longer. Oh, the main card pacing was awful. That's why it felt longer. Okay, finishes weren't at that much of a premium, but when your last two go the distance, that's always rough. The rest of the main card mostly went okay. Only one finish on the prelims. That was maybe what kind of hurt there. We'll also be previewing UFC on ESPN 54. They have to try this time because they had to sell tickets, so it'll be better. So we'll get a look at that. And we have news. Big news of the week. The UFC is moving to settle both of the lawsuits against them. And, well, we'll talk about it and why it depresses me. All right. I think that's the preamble. So interact with the product a little bit. Like, comment, subscribe, star rating, written review, whatever is applicable to your podcast platform of choice. Always appreciate any and all of that. Share on social media or with people you know in real life who you think might enjoy the show. So point them in our direction. We will try our best to entertain, educate, and generally contribute to your MMA viewing experience. So I think that's everything for me there. Alrighty, let's get into this, shall we? So UFC on ESPN 53 main event. Oh, sorry. Before we do that, forgot betting. Well, betting, picking, no gambling. I do not advise gambling. I do not advise using my picks in that respect. I'm not nearly consistently good enough at doing these kinds of things to make, say, hey, use that. All I do is pick winners and losers. But I occasionally will slip and say betting because picking, betting, yeah, I don't gamble and I don't advise anyone to. So with that legal disclaimer out of the way, how did we go? We went positive last night. Not great, but 7-6. Which of these annoyed me that I got wrong? I think only two. The co-main event, so Carl Williams and Justin Taffe, that annoyed me mostly because if you watched the fight, which I don't necessarily recommend, you can see why I picked Justin Taffe, right? Like, you can see how he could have won this fight. And instead, every time he got into a position that he was doing well, he made some boneheaded decision and then got wrestled for the rest of the round. Man, Justin Taffe, there's a handful of these guys. Taffe, Tai Tuivasa, that clearly have ability. But for some reason, the skill development is just not really there, and the fight IQ leaves something to be desired. He had Williams hurt in the first and then tried a flying knee. Like, I get what you're trying to do there, man, but If you don't time that perfectly, that's going to go badly, and then it went badly. So that one bothered me. The only one that I think I really should have known better. I picked Kurt Hollebaugh over Trey Ogden, and 30 seconds into that first round, I was going, "You idiot. You buffoon. You absolute boob. What were you doing?" Yeah, that one bothered me. The others that I got wrong, I'll stand by why I picked Billy Quarantillo, even though he lost surprisingly pretty badly. I will stand by not picking Edmund Shahbazyan to win, even though he did. But I just am not going to pick that guy to win fights at this point. Not for a while. Dobson being on short notice, this did give me a little bit of pause in real time, but I would have picked Todorovic, and I think Todorovic would have won that fight, honestly. But I maybe should have given Shahbazyan more of consideration than I did, but I'm not going to beat myself up over that one. Again, the Og not picking Trey Ogden, I am going to beat myself up over a little bit. Yeah, the others, sometimes you get them wrong. Jarno Ahrens turned up and had a better than expected performance. I knew, dude, Erosa and Hamosh was a coin flip anyway. I'm just, again, some of these I'm just not going to beat myself up over. Taffa, picking Justin Taffa against a somewhat competent fighter, that one I probably should have known better. And I definitely should have known better for Trey Ogden and Kurt Hollebaugh, so. Yeah, that's it for that. So again, 7-6. Not great, but back in the positive column, so I'll take it. 84-38 on the year with 3 no contests and one fight that just completely fizzled, which doesn't actually factor into anything other than some of my calculations, so. I've also had a bit of a debate. I don't know how I'm going to handle this. How should I handle fights that maybe after the fact are overturned? I'm not keeping individual spreadsheets for each individual fight night. All I'm keeping is my win-loss record for each one. So I don't. Maybe I should have. It's not like they take up a lot of space, but I don't know. It felt like that just felt like a little bit more work than I wanted to commit to this endeavor. Especially given that there's going to be a lot of them. So I don't know how I'm going to handle fights that get overturned. If somebody won and then fails a drug test and that's changed to a no contest, I'm not sure. I'm going to think about it. I might go back and revisit this later in the year. But that's the only thing because. Again, I'm not saving each individual pick, and I don't know if I want to go back and and try to go through everything previously. So I don't know. Again, I'm not sure about it. But it's something I'll be keeping in mind. But that's where we are in the year. All right, moving on to the fights. Main event, Rose Namajunas defeats Amanda Ribas via unanimous decision, 249-46 and a 48-47. I was 49-46. Fifth round could easily have gone to Amanda Ribas. The problem is I don't think she won the first, second, or fourth. And you gotta win 3 rounds if you're not gonna stop somebody. So there's that. What did I think of this? Couple of things. Rose Namajunas at flyweight is not the same kind of force she was at strawweight. She doesn't seem to have the same kind of firepower up here. And some of that's because people at 125 can maybe take a punch a little bit better. But she doesn't. She hit Amanda Ribas quite a bit. And just never. Very rarely was able to kind of deter her in ways that she had. Affected people hitting them when she was fighting at strawweight. So that's a bit of a consideration. The other problem I think Nama Yunus is running into at this point is there's just a lot of tape on her. I mean, she's been in the UFC for the vast majority of her career, right? I mean, she came into the UFC two and one. Then lost to Carla Esparza, and then, that started her whole UFC run. So, she's had 18 fights, and 15 of them have been in the UFC. Several of those have been for the title. How many times has she gone 5 rounds? You want a rematch? Second fight with Zhang Weili, and then the terrible third fight, or second fight rather, sorry, second fight with Zhang, second fight with Esparza, second fight with Joanna. And now this one, she went the distance against Manon Fior, she went the distance against Jessica Andrade, second time. There's just, at this point, a lot of tape on her, and that makes preparation different. She's not old, she's only 31. But the amount of tape that exists on you is a pretty big factor to consider when some of your performances start slowing. It's not always that you're slowing down. Some of it is your opponents are just a lot better at dealing with what you bring to the table now. She didn't quite seem as light on her feet. She might have been pacing herself more for 5 rounds, but that was a consideration. She won this largely on the back of Amanda Ribas making bad decisions. There were stretches when Amanda Ribas was doing some pretty good work. She would start timing her right hand okay. Had a good bead on some of Rose's movement. Then she couldn't help herself and just tried the headlock throw, and suddenly Rose is on her back, and the first time she did it, Rose rolls through and gets on top in side control. Like, good job. Rose's grappling ultimately kind of proved the deciding factor in the round she won. She'd get Amanda down, and Amanda just couldn't do much. Anytime they were scrambling, Rose was usually getting the better of it, but not exclusively. But once they settled, like, Amanda just couldn't generate motion from nothing. And, just kind of how that played. I don't know what the future. I lost about half of Rose's post-fight interview because the live feed cut out. Don't know why, but so I don't know if she called anyone out after the fact, but I don't know that flyweight is really going to hold much of a bright future for her, to be candid. I think moving away or like sort of distancing herself from Trevor Whitman, they're not completely separated, but I think pulling back from his coaching, I don't know who initiated that, but I don't think it has benefited her tremendously. So there's that. I mean, there was always, if you remember that second fight with Esparza, Trevor Whitman is giving her good advice, and then Pat Barry is basically saying the opposite, which is not always bad advice, to be abundantly clear. Like, I'm not trying to sit here and say Pat Barry is a terrible coach. I don't necessarily think he is. I don't know that he's great, but I don't think he's terrible. There was just a real disconnect of vision and strategy, and in that fight in particular, between the two lead voices in her corner, and that's not sustainable. So if Whitman took a step back, or they decided that, Barry is going to be the primary voice, okay, that's their decision. I think at this point, I don't know. Again, I don't know how much good fruit that particular decision is born. Just a thought. Ribas didn't look bad. She fought. She was there for all 5 rounds. Didn't gas out, which is a good thing. She was competitive in large stretches of this fight. There's just decision-making issues that Rose is super experienced. Has fought elite-level opposition for quite some time, and Ribas just went on instinct in places when she needed to be thinking, or maybe a better way to think about that, her instincts need to be more needed to be more refined, and it just she made some bad decisions, and it cost her. This was a winnable fight for her. I think that even the guy, one of the guys sitting here going, yeah, I gave Rose four rounds, you can see that this was winnable for Amanda Ribas. So, yeah, not a whole lot there. Again, I don't think the title at flyweight is really in Rose's future. I think she would really struggle against... I think she'd really struggle against either Grasso or Shevchenko. I don't know that I... She already lost to Manon Fiore. I would not favor her over Erin Blanchfield. We're going to talk about those two because they're the main event for the next card. But... I don't know. Rose is just a very weird fighter to get a handle on. The best version of Rose, I've said this a lot, the very best version of her is one of the best female fighters ever. Full stop. But she can't, has not demonstrated an ability to consistently bring that version of herself to bear, so I don't know. It was a fine enough fight, mostly. Not terrible, but pretty forgettable. Speaking of terrible, mostly terrible, co-main event, Carl Williams beats Justin Toffa via unanimous decision, 229-28 and a 30-27. Shame on the 30-27. I have no problem with Carl Williams winning this fight, but giving him the third round is a flat-out mistake. Toffa badly hurt him in that round, more than once. And Williams did nothing to overtake that deficit. Williams winning the first two rounds, cool. Now, he gets hurt in the first, but recovers, gets Toffa down, and then does enough work from enough good positions to overcome getting tagged on the feet a couple of times. No problem with Williams winning the first. I actually wouldn't, by the same token, actually, I don't... You could argue for Toffa in the first. It wouldn't convince me, but it's not... It's not an incoherent argument. Second round is all Williams. Third round, Williams sits on his lead. This fight sucked. This might go on my worst fight of the year list candidates, if I'm being honest. Next up, yeah, look, Justin Toffa, again, he has ability, man. You could see it. He landed some good punches, then had Williams hurt and tried a flying knee and just badly mistimed it. I don't even think Williams was ducking for a takedown. He just assumed he was going to. So it only kind of landed in the body, and all you've done is throw yourself at the wrestler with very little control over your momentum and physicality, and he grabbed him and took him down. Then, I think it was the second round, he was kind of doing okay again. He's landing some punches and then tries a head kick from an inadvisable distance on a guy the size, and he slips, and then, ta-da, you've given up the round again. Just really odd decisions. Like, I get trying to hit a spectacular move, but you've got to be certain, or more certain than he was given the circumstances. Like it was just a poor read. Next up, Edmund Shahbazyan knocks out AJ Dobson, 443 of the first. Dobson looked good. Fast hands was giving Shahbazyan trouble early. Shahbazyan forced a clinch and used that to kind of slow Dobson down just enough that when they broke apart and kind of came back together, Shahbazyan was able to land a bit of a left hand, more of like a forearm clothesline than a straight punch, but caught him behind the ear, wobbled him, got on top, pounded him out. Shahbazyan badly needed the win. Anytime somebody does this commentary, does the yay, they're back. His defense is still a serious problem. He's got firepower, but he gets hit a lot. That's just a problem he's running into. I still have not been... Dobson was not the guy who was going to give him a lot of problems in the way that he's been given problems. I need to see what Shahbazyan does when he's on his back. His cardio is still suspect. This was a needed win for him, but this did not answer any of the questions that he's been facing either. Bantamweight, Peyton Talbot, TKO's Cameron Simon, 21 seconds into the second round. Fun fight. Good performance out of Talbot here. I was hemming and hawing about this one a little bit last week. You could see why. It's not like Cameron Simon did badly here. He ate some serious shots in that first round. Recovered well and still lost the round, but recovered more or less well enough to keep the fight, to stay in the fight. Like, he had some good combination work, hit some really nice kick sequences. Just didn't seem to have the firepower to dissuade Talbot. And second round, Talbot clips him with a left hook, able to finish things off on the mat. Yeah, good performance from Talbot. Very good performance from him. Featherweight Yusuf Zalal comes back to the UFC, and he beats up Billy Quarantillo. Moves well. Billy Q can't corner him. More plodding. Not very light on his feet. Normally he is. A little bit surprising at how heavy Quarantillo looked. I don't mean, like, weight-wise. I mean the way he moved. He looked a bit more ponderous than usual. And he's not the most fleet-footed of guy, but this looked noticeably slower from him. And I'm not sure what to chalk that up to. But Zalal looked good. Fast, fast combination work. Pretty good movement around the cage. And then really nice finishing choke sequence from him. Good on Zalal getting back and getting a really good win. You know, Billy Quarantillo is nobody's easy fight. And Zalal made this look relatively easy, so hats off to him. Quarantillo after the fight, you know, no excuses. He said he's going to take some time. Don't know what to, I wonder if he wasn't injured, which is not an excuse. If you're hurt and you choose to fight hurt, like, that's on you. But I only bring that up because he just, a lot of how he fought, like, it's the same like strategy, but there were some execution and physical tools that he normally has that he didn't have here, and I just kind of wonder. And then kicking off the main card, Fernando Padilla defeated Luis Pauelo with a standing Darce choke, 245 of the first. Really solid performance from Padilla here. These two traded some kicks, but Padilla just unrelenting. Forward pressure. Landed some good combinations. Got him hurt, but as they were getting up, gets a front headlock. Grabs the Darce, but I almost thought it was a ninja choke because it was kind of while they were standing. He has the front headlock. Wasn't a ninja choke. Was a Darce. The arm was trapped. But he mentioned something interesting when he was talking us through it at the end. Standing Darces are rare. But he mentioned he was against the fence. So you could use the fence like you would use the mat if you're, you know, grappling. And use that as the barrier there. And really, which is true, you just don't see it used that way all that often. And good read on him. Got the tap. Really, really solid overall performance from Padilla. Really good stuff. On the prelims, Trey Ogden, 30-27, Kurt Holobow. Holobow just couldn't really get around the jab of Ogden. And then once Ogden got on top, just incredible top pressure. Only really started passing in the third round. Just hung out in half guard most of the time for the other two. But sick downward pressure, shoulder pressure. Started getting a little bit of ground and pound, but just, again, relentless control. Yeah, good stuff out of Ogden. I did not give him his due last week. That's on me, man. He's looked pretty darn good in the UFC thus far. Featherweight, Julian Erosa, guillotine choke, Ricardo Ramos, 215 of the first. Relatively back and forth on the feet. Something hit Ramos. We didn't see the cut until after the fight, after he got caught in the guillotine. But something hit him and opened up a big cut on his forehead. I mean, like, it's up kind of by the hairline, like on the forehead, not around the eyes. But it's like halfway across his head. It's like between the eyes, wait to like over where the giant cut. I don't know if it would have stopped the fight. I don't know how deep it was, but it was big. It was a big cut. Yeah, just Ramos trying to wrestle up from being on bottom. He'd gotten tagged, I think. and got caught in another guillotine choke. So something for him to work on, man. That's twice in a row he's been caught in that. Good win for Arosa. Good win for him. Again, fun little fight for 2 minutes. Bantamweight Miles Johns defeated Cody Gibson. Decision 30-27 across the boards. No issues with that. Johns just absorbed a lot of the pressure from Gibson and was able to land pretty good combinations and then out-wrestle him. Some pretty good top work from when it was there. Johns just kind of felt a step ahead the whole way. At featherweight, Jarno Ahrens beat Steve Wynn of unanimous decision 30-27 across the boards. This was your fight of the night. No issues with that for me at all. These two went after it. This was fun. This is a fun scrap between these two guys. Wynn was looking very good early and then got caught with a punch, and it really badly cut one of his lips. Blood was leaking out of his mouth the whole rest of that fight. Ahrens starts taking over, lands some really gnarly calf kicks, good combinations, really good pocket punching out of Ahrens. Wynn starts rallying a little bit more down the stretch. Again, not enough to win, but competitive. Good fight. Look this one up if you didn't see it. It was a good fight. Good little fight for 3 rounds. Women's bantamweight, Daria Zelenziakova. Zelezniakova. Defeated Montserrat Rendon via unanimous decision, 29-28 across the boards. Rendon did a lot of clinching, but struggled to get takedowns and really struggled to do anything with her clinch. Daria's face was a little bit more banged up. She wore more damage, but she landed a lot more. And again, Rendon didn't do anything with her takedowns and her clinch control. Nothing really to write home about there either way. Speaking of writing home about something, Andre Lima defeats Igor Severino. 252 of the second via disqualification. So, first round, these two went at it, man. This was good. This was a good fight. They were trading gnarly calf kicks. Relentless pressure from Severino. Walking into some punches, but landing punches, clinching. These two need the crap out of each other. They elbowed the crap out of each other. Severino used a bit more grappling, but struggled to kind of control things. Good first round. Second round, we're getting a little bit more of the same. Then Severino he's struggling to get takedowns more in the second round. And there's some fence grabbing going on from Lima. Let's be clear about that. But Severino gets a bit of a takedown. Lima wall walks pretty quickly, bounces up. Severino slips to his back, kind of on the hip, on the back, holding the high crotch, looking for a single leg. And again, there's been some fence grabbing from Lima. But Severino is got his head. He's trying to get his head. One of the ways you can help finish the single leg, well, the high crotch variation of it. If you can get your head like under their armpit, it can give you another posting mechanism to kind of force them in a direction and help you off balance them. If you start pulling the hips back one way and your head is pushing the other direction, that's a lot harder to maintain balance. It's not the most common finish for that takedown, but I think that's what he was sort of going for. So he's digging his head in there, trying to get the post up, the posting appendage, in this case his head, into the wedge, which would be the armpit of Lima. And Lima says something to the ref. And the ref halts things. Now, my assumption was he was going to warn Lima about fence grabbing. Because, again, he had been doing a bit of that. And Lima had complained a little bit earlier about Severino grabbing inside the gloves, which had been going. These two guys, not the most refined. So things were getting chippy there. A little bit dirty. So my assumption was, like, we'd kind of hit this point where things were stalling a little bit, and the ref was going to, like, stop. Okay, the both of you, knock it off. But he doesn't. He breaks them up, and he talks with Lima for a second, and Lima shows him something. And he goes over, talks to one of the commission officials, and says, I'd like to see a replay. I want to make sure about something. And Severino again is kind of showing off. No, sorry, excuse me. Lima's like, yeah. And turns out, in commentary, kind of mentioned like, Lima said he got bit. Now, I got thinking about this after the fact. And I don't watch a whole lot of regional MMA. I watch some, but I don't watch everything. It occurred to me, I've never seen someone cry wolf about biting. I've seen people fake or exaggerate low blows. I've seen people either fake or exaggerate or misclaim eye pokes. I've seen plenty of fighters get punched in the eye, go, he poked me, and the ref goes, no, he punched you, keep fighting. Or you know, that be I or you know, ah, he poked me in the eye, and no, he really didn't. I've seen that. Heck, I've seen Josh Koscheck claim he got kneed in the head when he was downed, and the replay clearly show that while the illegal knee was thrown, it did not land. Or, you know, guys who get kneed in the chest complain about getting kneed in the head. And like, I've seen all that. I've seen the gamesmanship come out about almost every foul in the book, except biting. I have never seen a fighter say he bit me when he wasn't bitten. Now, maybe it's happened, again, if you go smaller, if you go like really regional MMA, you will see some wild stuff. But I've never seen that one be a boy who cried wolf situation, right? And here's the thing about this. So he's claiming he got bit. And commentary, Brendan Fitzgerald, I mean, I don't know if this was just him or if there was a producer in his ear going. He said, you know, because the referee looks at some replay, like talks with Lima again, and then immediately is like, no, we're done. Fight's over. And Fitzgerald briefly goes, like, I would have liked to have seen maybe a hard warning. And here's the thing. If you're fighting over a rear naked choke and their forearm goes in your mouth, like, that's happened. Okay, like, sometimes that's just kind of what happens when you're fighting over that position. And you're not trying to bite them. Their arm is across your mouth, and they're pulling back real hard. And if you can't keep your jaw closed, it's going to open, and their arm's going to go in there. Like, that one, maybe I can see something of the argument. But anywhere else, biting should be an automatic DQ. They should have, straight up, man, Mills Lane should have disqualified Mike Tyson the first time he beat Evander Holyfield. He really should have, but he didn't. But then we get the camera goes over to Lima and he shows off the bite, and this is unambiguous. Like, this wasn't a I'm grinding my elbow back, my arm back against your head as you're trying to push forward, and you know, maybe there was something there. It wasn't that. I don't even know how he did that with his mouth guard in, because there's teeth marks on top and bottom. I suppose it would kind of depend on how well formed. If you get a super well formed mouth guard, then maybe you can still get the. Maybe some of those would be on the. Would still be visible on the. I don't know. But, like, there's. Again, this is unambiguous. There's a big bite mark on his arm. He just. Oh! Chomped on him. You can't see it clearly on the replay because, again, his head's kind of trying to dig in under the arm, and you don't have a great camera. But there's enough to see him. You kind of see him start to open his mouth at one point, and then you can't get around the fact that there's a giant bite mark on the guy's arm that was not there before that sequence. And as soon as they saw the mark, everyone on comment, because commentators were, again, kind of hemming and hawing about it. You got Fitzgerald there going, I don't know, maybe just a hard warning. And Felder going, well, look, under different circumstances, you know, sometimes if you're fighting over a front headlock or a guillotine choke, even then, like, you shouldn't bite. You know, I've never seen somebody accidentally get their mouth involved when you're fighting for a single leg on the fence like that. And then you see the real, like, oh no, you tried to cannibalize the guy. Slightly crazier. So Dana White said, you know, for getting bitten, I'm going to give him a bonus. And then in the back, he gets that tattooed. Like, I don't know of a tattoo artist that should be working on skin that was recently traumatized like that. But he gets the bite mark, like the bite impression tattooed, and then around his like first post-bite bonus. And posted that over, and Dana White was amused enough to throw another 25K at that, so it wound up being 50K. Severino was fired from the cut from the UFC immediately. He's going to get fined for this. Dude, you can get away with certain fouls. Like, you can get away with a low blow. Everybody gets like one low blow. Everybody gets three fouls. This is highly unofficial. But if you look at the history of MMA officiating, you get three fouls before they'll take a point. Somewhat dependent, now, like, you get one groin kick and two eye pokes, dependent on severity. And you, or like, one and two. You can't do the same one three times. That'll get you. But if you do, like, one eye poke, if it's not bad, and especially if it's, like, during the midst of trying to grab a clinch, or if you're just poking your fingers out there, no, but, like, there's ways to get a fair eye poke. You're going to get, nobody's going to take a point on the first groin strike unless you just straight up haul back and punt through the uprights. Like, deliberately. So you've got two, and you can get it to three if one of them's not severe or very, very accidental. And if you throw in a clash of heads, you're probably still fine. Like, that's just how this is. To say nothing of fence grabbing. And you can probably grab the fence once. Now, again, if you do all of these, but, you know, one fence grab, one low blow, and then you could probably get away with an eye poke or two of not serious, like, one eye poke, especially super accidental, you're probably still not going to get a point taken, which is somewhat ridiculous that you can accumulate this. The only foul that straight up instantly do not pass go, do not collect $200 is biting. There's almost no way to accidentally bite somebody. Even people who, again, even if you're going for a choke, like, we all kind of accept that that's, if the other guy's putting his arm around your mouth like that, there's, like, not consent to biting, but you understand the peril that's going on there, especially as you start leveraging backwards. Like, you're just accepting that, okay, this might happen. But short of that, you can't accidentally bite someone. It just, no. And if you're biting, we're done here. Everyone knows this. So, yeah. And then kicking everything off in a pretty terrible fight, Mick Parkin beats Muhammad Usman via unanimous decision, 29-20 across the boards. Usman looked miffed by this decision, but no, my man, you just didn't do enough. It wasn't a good fight. That might also go on my worst fight of the year list. I have to figure out how I want to handle that after this is all said and done. But yeah, that was it. That was the event. Just, it was never going to be great, but, dude, put a Rosa and Hamosh in your co-main event spot, and then, what else do we swap out? The rest of the main card, I would have swapped Shabazzian and the Shabazzian fight with, once Dusko Todorovic fell out, swapping Shabazzian versus Dobson for like Aarons and Wynn would have helped. Would have helped a lot. So anyway, your post-fight bonuses. I mentioned already, fight of the night, Aarons and Wynn, no issues there. You had Lima getting the bite of the night. This was the first ever UFC biting disqualification. I'd seen other biting DQs, There was one involving Norman Park that took place at, I think it was Cage Warriors, but don't quote me. I'd seen that before. For some reason, I thought one of those had been in the UFC, but I guess not. As an example of kind of the biting that might just happen when you're going for an improperly positioned rear naked choke, for example, Ronda Rousey and Liz Carmouche. Liz Carmouche actually goes for a rear naked choke on Ronda in that fight. But it's across the arm, and like after the fight, Carmouche did kind of tell Ronda, "Hey, technically you bit me," and you could see it, and Ronda just like apologized because she wasn't trying to bite. It was just your arm's across my face, we're going for that choke. That you might leverage the jaw open at some point. Performances of the night went to Peyton Talbot and Fernando Padilla. No issues with that either. I might have gone Zalal instead of maybe instead of, I don't know, Padilla's overall performance was a little bit, no, because Zalal was against a better quality of opponent. Might have thrown some Zalal consideration in there personally, but that's a little bit just me. My full report is in the MMA Zone of 411mania.com, so if you're interested in that, give it a read. Always appreciate that. And yeah, let's move on then, shall we? So UFC on ESPN, still on ESPN, big ESPN, 54. Main event is, hang on, do we actually have the full bout order? I'm going to double check, because Wiki hasn't been updated yet. Neither is the UFC's full bout order page. Okay. Don't know where the break is between main card and prelims for this one just yet, but I assume we will know that at some point in the near future. That was this last one. So, looking up the odds as well. Okay. There we go. I got all that. So, main event. Probably for the next shot at the flyweight title, one would assume. Erin Blanchfield. Okay, this will be in New Jersey. Blanchfield is a New Jersey girl. Blanchfield and Manon Fiore. This is a good fight. I don't think that's much of a complaint here for anybody. This is a tough one. Out on the feet, especially at distance, Fiore is pretty darn good. She fights long. She's got some good weapons from out there. It's not that Blanchfield is somehow incapable of striking, but that's not where she's going to have a tremendous advantage in this fight. But once they clinch up, that's dicier. Probably favors Blanchfield. Fiore doesn't have the worst clinch game in the world, but I think she's at a disadvantage there. On the mat, it is decidedly in favor of Blanchfield. If this were only three rounds, I actually might like Fiore's chances here. I think it's very possible for her to win the first two rounds. But her cardio's been a bit, there's a question mark there that I don't think is quite there for Blanchfield. And again, three rounds, you could make a much more compelling case for Manon Fiore over three rounds than you can over five at this point. Five rounds of dealing with Erin Blanchfield is just, that's a lot. That's a lot for anyone to deal with. Frankly, I like Blanchfield's chances to wear the gold in this division. And I don't say that lightly. But I just, that's where I am on this one. I am not saying that Fiore can't win this fight. What exactly are the odds here? Just as a brief aside. Not qu DraftKings a little bit out of line there. The rest of them are around minus 155 or so for Blanchfield. I think that's about right. That's about where I am on this one. So, not discounting Fjord. I mean, on Fjord, but Blanchfield is just a handful for anyone. Blanchfield over 5 rounds is a super handful. I expect, wouldn't be shocked to see Fjord win a couple of rounds. That wouldn't surprise me one bit, but cardio is an issue. Grappling on the mat will be the bigger cage helps Fjord. If this were at the Apex, that would swing things even heavier in favor of Blanchfield, I think. But go on with Blanchfield, and I don't feel too bad about that one. Again, not discounting Fjord. Fjord's very good. She will probably fight for the belt at some point. Wouldn't surprise me. And I actually would like Fjord's chances against Alexa Grosso, specifically. Just how they match up. But Blanchfield has been. She's been pretty much unstoppable to this point. Her only loss was a split decision before she got to the UFC. Against Tracy Cortez back in 2019. Since coming to the UFC, she has been a wrecking ball. I don't think any of these have even been close. Okay, the Taylor Santos fight wasn't a total blowout. But that was also a pretty. Again, that wasn't a total blowout in favor of Blanchfield, but I think that was. Okay, Santos won one of the rounds. But the other two. Yeah, that was. That was a very clear step up, I think, for Blanchfield, but I think 5 rounds favors her against a lot of the whole division. Just her style over 5 rounds is very, very difficult to handle. So, going with Blanchfield there. All right, co-main event, Vicente Luque and Joaquin Buckley. Buckley at welterweight is what, 1-1? No, 2-0, sorry. Knocked out Andre Fialho. Beat Alex Morono, that was okay. It was a solid win. So welterweight seems to have rejuvenated him a little bit, but Luque is. He just broke a two-fight losing streak, in fairness. That was. Cause. Well, but that was. He had the scare with the brain bleed or something, didn't he? Yeah, Luque did. After the Jeff Neal fight, that's why he was gone for a whole year before coming back against RDA. Luque's two losses were to Belal Muhammad, who is probably your next title challenger, question mark. And then the knockout to Jeff Neal. Rebounded okay against Dos Anjos. This is actually kind of a tough one. Yeah, the odds are almost calling this one a coin flip. I think Buckley might have some cardio issues. Oh man, Luque's good. Luque's just also. That's catching up to him, man. He's only 32, but he's an old 32. This is a guy with 32 fights. Has a UFC career that dates back to July of 2015. And. I don't know. Am I really convinced that Buckley's found his footing enough at this point to reliably beat Vicente Luque? I am not sure about that. This is a really close fight. I'm gonna lean towards Luque here. Not by a lot. And Buckley could well starch him. That wouldn't surprise me at all. But I'm gonna lean towards Luque. I think he'll be able to absorb some of what Buckley does, and Buckley can be a tad gun shy. Luque might be able to force him into that headspace. So, slight lean towards Luque. If you do gamble, stay away from that fight. That's almost impossible to predict. All right, next up at middleweight. Oh, Chris Weidman. He's fighting Bruno Silva. Look, I was around for Chris Weidman's ascension. I was around for his title win, his title reign. He's got an underrated title reign at middleweight, by the way. Not just beating Anderson Silva, because he beat him twice. Not just that. His win over Lyoto Machida is a darn good fight. That's forgotten. It's a great fight. It's not a super great fight, and it kind of gets, again, lost a little bit in the discussion. That's a great fight. Go watch that if you haven't. He beat Vitor Belfort. Like, his. Didn't he have one more win at middleweight? Was it only those two title defenses? Anyway, my point there is my respect for Chris Weidman's career and what he's been able to accomplish is pretty well set. I like the guy. He's a good guy in the sport, but I don't know that I can pick him to win at this point. I mean, Weidman's last win was a decision over Omari Akhmedov in 2020. Look, this guy was going ever since that loss to Luke Rockhold, where he took an inadvisable amount of damage. Didn't help that he followed that up by getting knocked out by Yoel Romero. Then Gegard Mousasi stopped him after that. He got hurt by Kelvin Gastelum. He came back and won the fight, but he got dropped at the end of that first round. Jacare knocked him out. Dominic Reyes knocked him out. Then he broke his leg against Uriah Hall. Look, I again, man, if you missed Chris Weidman's rise, go back and rewatch it, man. It's great. I absolutely mean that. It is great. He was a great. He was a very. Was he a great champion? Three title defenses, and one of them being one of them a rematch with Anderson Silva that you win. Having a really good fight with Lyoto Machida. Yeah, I'd say it was a really good. What's my threshold for great? It probably is three. I can start considering you a great champion at three title defenses. Especially like those guys were all deserving. And then he signed to fight Luke Rockhold, like, and had a good fight with him too, man. That was a good fight up until it wasn't. I don't know that he should still be fighting. I mean, he didn't have almost anything for Brad Tavares in that fight, in that comeback fight. He's 39. In fact, he'll be 40 in June. I hate to say I'm at a point where I can't really pick him because, I'm rooting for the guy, for whatever that's worth, but Bruno Silva's good. I don't know that he's legitimate world champion good, but he's had a bit of a rough stretch lately. I mean, okay. Lost to Alex Pereira, no shame. He was winning the Gerald Merchart fight before the guillotine choke, if memory serves. Beats Brad Tavares. Doesn't quite have it for Brendan Allen, and then he actually gave Shardar Magomedov a pretty decent fight. He wound up losing. I think he was a little bit too comfortable off of his back, but that wasn't a blowout, if memory serves. It was 30-27. Again, not a blowout. He won every round, but man, again, Bruno Silva's pretty good. And I just think I can't pick Weidman at this point. So, rooting for the guy, but can't pick him. All right, middleweight still, Sultan Ruzboyev. Okay. This is one of those names that I apologize because there are names that come from different cultures that sometimes just bring out the accent. Even if you trying to speak with that accent is not good, I can't say Ruzboyev without having some kind of a Russian twang. Look, it's true of certain Latin names. I can't say Quinones without doing a little bit of the Enyas. It's a Quinones. It's not Quinones. Quinones. There's just some names that it comes out because that's the way it sounds, and that's one of those for me. So I apologize because I know my. If I try to put on the Russian accent, it's not good. I'm not a professional voice actor or anything like that. I don't necessarily have the best feel for it, but I can't say Nil Sultan Ruzboyev without. I mean, I could really stupidly accent it up to be like a Nur Sultan Ruzboyev, right? Something like that. It just comes out a little bit when you try to pronounce it. Anyway, he's fighting Cedricus Dumas. Not trying to dump on Dumas here. Because he's what, 1-1 in the UFC? 2-1. Lost to Josh Fram, then beat Cody Brundage and Abu Azaitar. I don't like his chances here. Ruzboyev 33-8, 2 draws, 2 no contests, 9-fight winning streak. Had a good win in his UFC debut when he beat Bruno Fajera. Not a lot. I don't have a lot of hesitation picking Ruzboyev here. So there's that. Moving on, featherweight. Hang on. Sorry, Topology is listing. Where's Chidi and Jaquani and Reese McKee? Is that further down? Yes, it is. Okay. I'm going with the list as currently presented, and I'll adjust if they switch the bout order. Okay, featherweight, Bill Algeo and Kyle Nelson. Not a bad fight, actually. Bill Algeo, bit up and down in the UFC, lost to Ricardo Lamas and Ricardo Hamosh, and a split decision to Andre Feely. I think I scored it for Feely, but you could have given that to Algeo. He's 4-1 in his last 5, though. Wins over Joe Anderson Brito, Herbert Burns, current 2-fight winning streak over TJ Brown and Alexander Hernandez. That's nothing to sneeze at. Kyle Nelson, this is the monster, right? Yeah. He had a really rough start to his UFC career. He went 1-4 in his first 5. Losses to Diego Fajera. That was up at lightweight. So comes back to featherweight, loses to Matt Sales, beats Polo Reyes, loses to Billy Quarantillo, loses to Jai Herbert, goes to a draw with Duho Choi. That he was kind of lucky to get. There was a point deduction to Choi in the 3rd round for a headbutt. By the way, I'm not opposed. I was not necessarily opposed to the point deduction there, if memory serves, in that fight. But that's at the just that's kind of at the whim of the ref because it wasn't repeat. I don't think it was repeated. And absent that point deduction, Choi wins that fight. His last 2 wins, he's kind of gotten back on track, beating Blake Builder and Fernando Padilla. He's a pretty big guy for the weight class. His cardio is going to be the question mark here because Algeo pushes a pretty good pace. What are the odds on this one? Yeah, the odds are about 2-1 in favor of Algeo. Might be a touch steep there. Again, Nelson is not a slouch, but he's also relies a lot on clinch work, and that. For me, the cardio's the big thing. He has slowed noticeably in most of his fights, and Algeo doesn't. So, lean towards Algeo. Not by a whole. I think 2-1 might be a bit pushing your luck there. Let me put it like that. Welterweight, Chidi and Jaquani and Reese McKee. Chidi, Chidi, Bang, Bang. Three-fight losing streak. Yeah, he and Gregory Rodriguez had a pretty good fight in 2022 where he opened up a nasty cut, but Rodriguez robocopped through it and stopped him. Split decision to Albert Duraev. I scored it for Duraev, but I don't think I objected to the split. Then Mikhail Oleksijczyk stopped him his last time out. So he needs a win pretty badly. McKee, I think, has been a relatively unimpressive thus far. He's 13-5-1. And Jaquani, 22-10. Yeah, 13-5-1 for McKee. He lost his he's 0-3 in the UFC. Jeez. Oh, right. So he's the guy that lost to Khamzat Chimaev, and I'm pretty sure Chimaev's UFC debut. Then he lost to Alex Morono and got cut. Won three fights, got back, and lost to Ange Losa. I don't think I'm going to have much of a problem. This feels like a little bit of a bounce back for Njokuani here. And I don't have a problem picking him. Njokuani. Make sure I'm spelling that right. Yeah. Wrong button. Okay, featherweight, Nate the Train in the UFC, Nate Landwehr and Jamal Emmers. Landwehr's usually good for some fun. It's never exactly what you think, but it's kind of fun. Had a three-fight winning streak broken his last time out when he took a big step up in class. Like, he wins against Ludovic Klein, David Onama, and Austin Lingo. Respectable winning streak. Then he steps all the way up to Dan Ige and is found wanting. And Dan Ige is a top-tier featherweight still. Emmers. Let's see. Trading wins and losses while going 3-3 in the UFC. Lost to Giga Chikadze. He fought into a split decision, though. Beat Vince Cachero. Got heel-hooked by Pat Sabatini. Ouch. Beat Khushreni Askabov, lost to Jack Jenkins. That was a tough fight. That was a good fight, actually, I seem to recall. But Jack Jenkins that's a tough man to beat. Most recently, he beat Dennis Bazukia. He missed weight, though. Look at Emmers real fast. I need a picture. Where are you, sir? Aljo and Nelson. Are they saying this? Okay, hang on. Other thing about this. This was supposed to be Nate Landwehr and Pat Sabatini. Sabatini had to pull out. Emmers. Stepping. The short notice is a factor. The short notice might tip me towards Landwehr here. He's a tough out, man. The odds are with Emmers. That's a little interesting. How do I feel about this? Landwehr's hittable. That's the big problem that he's going to run into here, is Landwehr's hittable. I think I'm still going to pick him. This might be foolish, but I think the short notice is going to tip me in his favor. Come back next week. We're in Ico. What the heck was I thinking? EHR. Not HER. There we go. Might be very wrong about that one. Jamal Emmers is, again, a little bit up and down, but I don't know. I don't mind picking it. If you were to tell me to pick an underdog, one, I'd wait to see which way the odds tip in Luque and Buckley if they don't close as a pick. I'm going to go with that one. But Nate Landwehr is the underdog here. I don't hate it. I mean, I don't hate Kyle Nelson as the underdog either, for the record. But women's strawweight, Virna Jandiroba and Lupi Godinez. Jandiroba, she's pretty good. Her UFC losses are to Carla Esparza, Mackenzie Dern, and Amanda Ribas. I thought she had a pretty good... I did not agree with that Esparza decision. There was a lot of lay and pray from Esparza there. Current two-fight winning streak, wins over Angela Hill and Marina Rodriguez. Lupita Godinez. Four-fight winning streak. Two of those are splits. I agreed with her beating Cynthia Calvillo. Don't think I agreed with her beating Tabitha Ricci, but I don't remember enough specifically. The wins over her decision over Emily Ducati was perfectly fine, and then she choked out Elise Reed. Janji Roba's grappling might be a, her jiu-jitsu might be a bit too much for Godinez, who tends to lean on clinch work and being just a slightly better wrestler. And again, it's not like Janji Roba is some great clinch work fighter. On the ground, especially on top, Janji Roba is going to have some advantages. But if Godinez makes this a clinch fight, I think her clinch is probably better. Yeah, let me go with Godinez. Not sold on that one, but I don't mind leaning there. Featherweight, this should be fun. Julio Arce and Herbert Burns. I don't mean to disparage Herbert Burns here, but he's 36. He hasn't fought since July of 2022 when he refused to get up against Bill Algeo, basically. Lost to Daniel Pineda before that. Again, I'm not trying to disparage the man, but that's a long layoff, and he has not looked good the last two fights before that. Arce, eh, again, up and down guy. Traded wins and losses recently. Beat Andre Ewell, lost to Song Yadong, beat Daniel Santos, lost to Montel Jackson. I still think this is Arce. The layoff for Burns, like, that's a big layoff, and especially coming off of some less than stellar performances. Going with Arce here. Featherweight, Denis Bazukja, and it's Bazukja, not Bazukja. Denis Bazuka. She's going with Bazuka. Screw it. Your last name's close enough to a hand-propelled rocket like Bazuka. Take Bazuka. versus Connor Matthews. Matthews 7-1. I believe this is his UFC debut. Two wins. Yeah. Bazukia 11-4. 0-2 in the UFC. Again, lost to Sean Woodson and then Jamal Emmers. They might be setting up Matthews if they liked what he did that second time, because he's fought twice on the Contender Series. This might be Bazooka's last chance. Are they setting Matthews up? Are they giving him a favorable fight? Is that what's going on here? It might be. I don't know. Bazooka hasn't looked out of place. Two tough losses. I don't know if Matthews is going to be able to replicate what Emmers did. Now, you know what? Potentially foolish pick here. I'm going to do the tea leaves reading thing here and go with Matthews. Not sure I love that one. Not for me, though. Let's see. Next. What do we have next? I think listed here is light heavyweight Joy. The pleasure man, Anton Turkali, against Ibo Aslan. Is Aslan the first Turkish fighter to make it to the UFC? I want to say no, but I can't think of who else would have done it. Let me check real fast. Right. Nope, he wasn't. There was another one. You have to go way back in the Wayback Machine for this one, but my memory was like, yeah, there you are. Alp Ozkalic. He made his UFC debut in 2013 and beat Darren Uenoyama. This was at flyweight. Then proceeded to lose to Luis Smolka, John Lineker, and Ben Wynn. That's a tough. Those are some really good featherweights for 2014, 2015. Got cut, then lost on the regionals on Kunlun fight and retired. But okay, not the first Turkish guy to make his way to the UFC, but probably I think the first in a while. I don't remember one outside of Oskalic. Could be wrong there, but I think so. So Aslan, let's see. On a 4-fight winning streak, one on the Contender Series, and he's fighting a guy who's what, 1-3 in the UFC? 0-3 in the UFC. I half wanted to give to Carl. Yeah, Aslan. They're setting that guy up for a win, pretty obviously. Odds are closer than I expected there, but I don't know. I can tell what they're trying to do with that one. Not as convinced that Matthews is being set up, but that feels like, again, set up is the wrong word, but have a clear outcome in mind. Let's see, women's flyweight, Victoria Dudakova and Melissa Gatto. Gatto lost her last two, Tracy Cortez and Ariane Lipsky. One or two before that, Victoria Leonardo and Sajara Eubanks. She stopped Sajara Eubanks. I forgot about that. Good body kick. She's been out of action for a while, July of last year. Dudakova, I seem to recall, has struggled a bit in the UFC. Where are you listed here, ladies? There you are. No, she won her UFC. Is she 2-0 in the UFC or 1-0? 2-0, 14-fight winning streak, wins over Estela Nunes and Jin Yu Frey in the UFC. Excuse me, Frey. She missed weight for the Frey fight, though, so that's worth paying attention to. This is a step up for Dudakova. Again, her UFC wins, I already mentioned them. Gatto is a step up from that, I think. But if you've listened long enough, you know that it amuses me to pick Russians to beat Brazilians. And I think this is, look, I'm not only picking it because of that. I think Dudakova has a good shot at winning. If I had clear, I'm not saying there's no case to be made for Gatto, but if I had a really clear feeling like, yeah, Melissa Gatto has X, Y, and Z advantages, I would go the other way, but go with Dudakova, and I'm prepared to eat that one if I'm wrong. Like, whatever. Middleweights, Andrei Petroski and Jacob Malkoon. Petroski coming off of a rough loss to Michel Pereira, and I thought he lost to Gerald Meerschaert, straight up. Petroski's stock has been falling a little bit lately. He's got cardio issues. He's a strong enough wrestler, but again, it's not something he can maintain. And Jacob Malkoon is just like, yeah, I'll wrestle you, and I'll wrestle you forever and a day. Coming off of a DQ loss to Cody Brundage, he elbowed Brundage in the back of the head, and look, man, Malkoon was wearing him out. Unfortunate loss for him. He hit him in the back of the head. That's not really in dispute. Like, pick your shots better, man. But that was not close. I think Malkoon will probably, he might have a rough first round, but I don't have a problem picking him to win here. Again, Petroski's stock has been taking some hits. And bantamweight, Angel Pacheco and Caolin Longren. I'm mispronouncing that gentleman's name. I know it. I apologize. I can never remember how to pronounce, because it's Irish, and I can just never remember how that's supposed to be pronounced. So forgive me, sir. This is the guy who pissed off all of France and then didn't have anything to offer. Angel 7-2. Lost on the Contender Series to Danny Silva, but got this call anyway. Loughran. Again, lost his UFC debut to Taylor Lapalus. And had a long amateur career. I don't know about this one. Let me have a look. Where are the odds for this? There you are. The odds really like Loughran. Yeah, I was not horribly impressed with him when he fought Lapalus. These might be a bit heavy in his favor in a way that I don't like, but I'm okay. I'm okay leaning with the odds on this one. And not, maybe not to the tune that they are, but feels a little bit like, I don't know. I didn't see Pacheco's loss on the Contender Series, so I can't speak to that, but. Well, there we are. So I'm okay leaning Loughran. Again, I may not like him. Like some places, I'm like 3.5 to 1. That seems a bit steep, but that's also just me. And there you have it. So Saturday, MMAZone411mania.com. Y'all know where to find me. I'll be covering it. Stop by and say hello. I always appreciate that. Okay. Let's get the depressing news out of the way first, shall we? So, UFC lawsuit update. The UFC is looking, and the plaintiffs are looking to settle. They've announced that they're going to... So the way this works. The parties have agreed, in principle, to a settlement, but the judge still has to sign off on it. The same thing is true if you go to the criminal side of things. If the state and the defendant reach a plea bargain, the judge still has to agree to the terms. Now, in criminal cases, it's like 99% the judge goes along with the plea bargain. It's incredibly rare. In civil cases, I think it's even rare. It's like 99.5.9, something like, I don't know the exact number, but I'm just trying to express it's exceedingly rare for the judge to go against the terms of a settlement or a plea bargain. Not impossible, just very rare. So unless the judge bucks all kinds of trends here, the UFC has settled both lawsuits, not just the one, if you'll recall. There was the one brought by Kung Lee et al. That covered a specific time period, and the one that had been brought by Cage and Johnson that covered from that time period to contemporary. Okay. So both lawsuits are apparently being settled for a combined... Not all terms are known. This would not... I'm going to give you a number, and then I'll explain why this is not as much as you think it is. For $335 million. Now, let me explain to you why that's not a lot of money in this case. So, first of all, why would you settle in this case? Nate Quarry talked a little bit about this and then got a little pissy about how dare you criticize me with that long Teddy Roosevelt quote that people who are just sensitive to criticism like to throw out there. But first of all, he can't talk about everything because there will probably be some non-disclosure attached to this. And you can, and at a bare minimum, you can't talk about it before it's signed off on by the judge. So you can present the generalities, but there might be specifics we have to wait on. But anyway, his point was we were seeking injunctive relief, which is we want the judge to be able to stipulate about contract structure, that something is so onerous that the judicial system can then again give injunctive relief, which might then be challenged, but that's a whole other thing. To do that, they would have had to merge the two different lawsuits. And in the process of doing so, would have had to restart big portions of the suit. They would have had to reopen discovery, which is basically, you know, evidentiary fishing. It's everybody gets to depose each other. We get all of your documents, blah, blah, blah. It's a long process. they would have had to reapply for class certification, which had been granted already for the first lawsuit, but not necessarily the second. In theory, precedent from the second would have applied, from the first one would have applied to the second, but it hadn't been granted for the second one yet. Might have been different. And again, because nothing had changed necessarily contract structure wise, it should have potentially been able to just roll over, but you never quite know. And this thing has been going on for 12 years. That first lawsuit was filed in 2012. So this has been a long process. The way the American legal system is set up, it is very grueling if you are suing someone with more money than you. So that was certainly a consideration. They didn't want to have to put, they didn't want to have another 5 years. I don't think, we probably wouldn't have had another 12 years to get back to where they are now, but it would have been a number of years. When you reopen discovery, that's a process. Again, that takes a long time. There would have been some motions, there would have been appeals, they would have refiled for class certification, they might have got it re-granted, that would have been appealed because this one was. Even if that slapped down again, it's just, it's time and it's legal fees. And oh, I hate to phrase it this way, I really, really do. But when the UFC presents a big number, what is perceived as a big number, $300+ million, if you're fighters and you've never seen that many zeros in front of you before, it's going to seem like a lot of money. So here's why it's not. First of all, if you're a lawyer working class action, this is what, or it's referred to as tort law. You love this because your fee, pretty standard legal fee, by the way, is right around 30% to a third. Now, this can be somewhat negotiated depending on the law firm and the case, but because some places try to go for 50%, which I find egregious and. But some law firms or lawyers will try that. I get 50% of the ruling or the settlement or what have you. Most judges strike that down. 30% is kind of industry standard. 30% plus or minus like 3 to 5 is kind of industry standard. About a third. Again, some places might go 25. If you think it's going to be a big number and you want to try and entice clients to you for this, then okay, we'll only take 25 instead of 30. And for big numbers, that 5% can be a lot. So the legal team is going to take their third off the top. It's kind of how that works. So the lawyers are getting $30 million out of this. That, again, that's fair. No, sorry, that would be 10th. Ugh, I can't do math. That's late. They're getting about $100 million, 100 and some odd million. That's what the law firm will get. That's about industry standard. Again, you may think, wow, that's kind of egregious, but that is what it is. It's why some, for the record, this is why some law firms will also do the we won't charge you hourly legal fees. These types of firms are heavily incentivized to settle because they're not generating hourly fees. They only get a decent chunk if there's some kind of settlement or judgment in their favor. A lot more settlements come in under those circumstances for somewhat obvious reasons. I don't know what the circumstance was here. I don't know if the law firm in question was going off of judgment or settlement or if they were charging hourly. If you're going to invest in a, you know, multiple year-long thing, there's usually hourly legal fees involved. So that's the whole thing. So first of all, 100, okay, this was what, 335. So a third of that, for the sake of quick math, gone. Off the top. That's how that usually works. Then that remaining amount, So 220 some odd million, 222 and a half, whatever. Call it 223 for the sake of easy math. That amount of money is now dispersed evenly over everyone who falls into the class. The way this math is going to break down is it's going to be, I saw some people, I think the people who were doing the math on this earlier were not doing the legal fees removal first. We're saying 200K, give or take, per fighter. It's probably going to be less. So for the sake of, I think they were talking like 225. So for the sake of my argument, let's say it's 190. 190 grand. I'm not saying that's not a lot of money. Right? I am saying suddenly your 335 million judgment becomes 190 grand that you then have to pay taxes on. So tax that, so take 60% of that because taxes in the United States. To say nothing of how this might affect overseas fighters, by the way. That's a whole other thing. So, congratulations on your $80,000. No, sorry, that's a bit glib. If it is 190, cut it in half, right? Give or take. So, once again, I can't do math. 95? 90 and 90 is 185. Yeah. 95 grand. When it's all said and done, the actual amount that is going to be usable by each individual fighter who qualifies as part of this class is going to be less than 100, is probably going to be less than 100 grand. And that is some depressing math, isn't it? Because this lawsuit, again, this settlement would cover both suits. Both. If you want to know the other reason I am depressed by this, if you don't know why most class action suits get big money, it's because you're dealing with big companies. For a lot of places, $325 million is a lot of money. For the UFC, $325 million was about their profit from 2022. Understand something? I didn't say revenue. Profit. If you are paying out the profit, give or take, for 1 year, to maintain your monopolistic position for at least the next decade, that is nothing. Believe me, that is nothing. That is absolutely nothing. There's nothing of the fact that apparently this is kind of a this, they might be able to list this as a tax deduction or a tax write-off for the business. Nothing. Freaking nothing. This is it, man. Like, this was your last shot. Barring some individual legislator getting a real bug in their ear about wanting to legislate some variation of the Ali Act, you're done now. Because current UFC contracts have a clause that says they will not, take part in class action lawsuits against the UFC. Now, I don't know how legal that is, but that's where they are. For about 1 year's profit, the UFC secured their monopoly for a long time. I am not anti-UFC. Please don't misunderstand me. I have been more than happy to defend that organization when I thought it was in the when I thought it needed defending. My voice doesn't mean a whole lot. I don't kid myself about that. But for whatever value my voice does have, when I think the UFC has been maligned, were unfairly criticized, I have been more than happy to stand up and say they're in the right. This is depressing. And I know there's a here here there's a couple of reasons this is depressing. Here's the other one. Look, no, I don't know any fighters personally. Okay, let me start there. But a lot of the people who have been banging this drum or talking about it have said fighters have reached out to them and said, "Knock it off, we're fairly paid." Which is categorically untrue. If you're a fighter in the UFC and you think you are fairly paid, believe me, by the economic models of every other thing that you should be fairly compared to, you are grossly underpaid. Let me start there. But if fighters aren't going to advocate for themselves, what are we doing? Okay, you think fighter pays fine. You think you're fine getting 12% revenue year over year. Probably less than that at this point. Okay. There's a point at which you get what you ask for. And people are going to stop talking about this is the other thing. You had a lawsuit out. You had some the editorial perspective was this was part of the public discourse. And well, now it's going to go away. It's going to take a giant step back from everyone talking about MMA to the extent that anyone is. And it's so sad watching people advocate against themselves like this. So we still have to wait for the judge to sign off on it, but it would be wildly newsworthy if the judge doesn't. In the like in just in legal circles, not even in the MMA sphere. It is so rare. It is the vast majority of settlement terms are okayed. So yeah, the UFC's un man, the UFC's business practices are if you are any other MMA organization in the world, this was a giant hit to you. A giant hit. Because there is nothing stopping the UFC's utter stranglehold on the market. Not a darn thing. And apparently everyone's okay with the fighters getting exploited. A big part of why I don't think there's as much ethical complaints around fighting is because of the compensation. And, dude, you're watching guys in MMA alter the course of their lives for almost nothing. And is it any wonder so many people are starting to fall away from the sport? All right. Speaking of other MMA organizations, it was officially announced that the Bellator Championship Series, which is a stupid title, they're being broadcast on Max. So if you have that service, you can find Bellator events live streaming and on demand going forward. They had their first one. They were in Ireland. One of the Pitbull brothers, Patricio Pitbull, got a win. Corey Anderson won the vacant Bellator light heavyweight title. There was a really nice knockout early on in the on the undercard. Beautiful elbow. But on the whole, Bellator has no value, the name. Bellator has no fan base. Bellator has nothing. Neither does the PFL, for that matter. Because nobody associates the sport with anything other than the UFC, and nothing is happening to change that. All right. On that depressing note, let me check Twitter, see if anything crazy is broken. If not, we will do plugs and get out of here. Nope, nothing new. So, plugs. If you like my other podcast, and I hope you do, I am part of a double shot this week. There will be on Tuesday at 9 p.m. Eastern. We are moving, Damn You Hollywood, we are moving it from Monday to accommodate one of our guests. We will be talking about, this will be me, Mark Radulich, Ronnie Adams, and, wait, Ryan gonna be on that or not? I think that lineup has changed a few times. So, I'm not sure about that one anymore. At a bare minimum, myself and Mark Radulich, I think we're having, I'm pretty sure Alexis. Again, I don't know about the others. Maybe. At least those three. We'll see. We'll be talking about on Tuesday, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. Tune in for that. I haven't seen it yet, so I don't have an opinion. Most of the people I'm aware of have been moderately positive. Forgettably positive, I think is kind of the best way to phrase it. I know some people, though, that have been a little bit more critical of it, so I don't know. We'll have to see where I land. Then Wednesday, there will be a Damn You Hollywood featuring primarily the Unholy Trinity. It's myself, Alexis Haina, Jason Teasley, and I think Dorian will be joining us for that. We will be talking about the recently released Late Night with the Devil. So, if you're a fan of horror movies, tune in for that. We'll be giving it a discussion. And I'm not on that Thursday one, am I? No. Okay. Sorry. There's a Thursday thing as well. I'm not on it, but wanted to double check and make sure. Okay. So, yes, and then you can find my coverage of MMA and professional wrestling over at 411mania.com. MLW stuff, I have to double check. I feel like I missed one, but I don't know. To the best of my knowledge, we weren't sent a screener for that, or at least my editors didn't get anything to me, so I'll double check that. WWE SmackDown on Friday. WrestleMania is coming up, so be aware of that. And UFC event on Saturday, so tune in for any and all of that. Next week, we are back here to review UFC on ESPN 54, and we will preview. They're running this again against like night one of WrestleMania. I imagine there'll be an earlier start time for this, but maybe not. UFC on ESPN plus 98. We are back at the warehouse for Brendan Allen versus Chris Curtis. This was supposed to be Brendan Allen versus Marvin Vettori. Vettori pulled out. In steps Chris Curtis. These two fought a few years ago. Curtis TKO'd Allen. So there's that. What else do we have on this card? Find me something that doesn't suck, please. Trevor Peak is hilarious as a fighter. Hernandez and Jackson, maybe. I got a soft spot for Court McGee, but I imagine his career is about ready to wind down. No, I got nothing. Oh, wait. Ignacio Bahamondes and Christos Yagos. Okay, that one might be fun. Jeez, how many fights is this? Hang on. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Yeah, 14. Oh, wait, Morgan Chartier. Okay, the last pirate. He's fun. Okay, so we found three. 3 out of 14. God help us. All right. Full preview next week, so tune in for that. Until then, thank you all again very, very much. I appreciate you. Stay safe out there, and until next time, continue to be well, be safe, and behave.